Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing. In this episode, we speak with Ross Hall, one of the founders of the Weaving Lab. At the Weaving Lab, Ross is working to develop a framework for the emerging field of weaving. Weaving, in this context, is a process of aligning people, fostering collaborations, and creating systemic change to transform a neighborhood or organization into an empowering learning ecosystem centered around universal well-being. We've asked Ross to elaborate.
Hi, thanks very much for having me today. My name is Ross Hall, and I'm a co-founder of The Weaving Lab. The Weaving Lab is a global community of people who are growing the field of weaving learning ecosystems, which I can explain. So our North Star is essentially the idea that humanity's deepest purpose and highest aspiration is to thrive. This is our starting point, where thriving is a collective matter. You know, I think COVID has shown us or reminded us perhaps that we are all wholly interdependent. And that means that my personal well-being is inextricably entwined with yours and the well-being of all humans, and the well-being of humanity is inextricably entwined with the well-being of all other life. So, you know, I think it was Donella Meadows who talked about this idea that a healthy cell must live in a healthy organ, which must live in a healthy body, in a healthy family, a healthy community, a healthy species, and in a healthy planet. So there's this idea of thriving as our North Star, what sometimes I call universal well-being. And for many years, I've been working in this field of trying to figure out, well, if that is our ultimate purpose as a species, what is it? How do we get there? Can we move forwards? Particularly in the context, of course, where now we're faced with so many challenges to our collective well-being. It's not just pandemics, of course, but it's all the other things that we're currently faced with, including increasing levels of poverty and inequity and exclusion and forced migration and slavery and unemployment and everything that goes with that, loneliness and depression and anxiety and anger and violence and pollution and resource depletion and climate change and, you know, everything else, including biodiversity loss, which may be the most impactful existential threat that we're facing. How do you actually move towards thriving in that really complex context? And so my work's taken me into that question of, which is, how do we learn to live for universal well-being, or how do we learn to thrive together? And it's really interesting when you ask people, and I've been doing this for 15 years, I must have asked thousands of people in all sorts of settings, from rural villages in Africa to kind of swanky offices in New York or wherever. And you get the same answers everywhere. But you say, you know, what does it really mean to live for universal well-being? And people will say, oh, it's all about being empathic and being compassionate, or being self-aware, being kind, being generous, being tolerant, being resilient, being thoughtful, being wise, etc. You get this long list of always the same things. What's particularly interesting about how people's responses is that there's a very strong emphasis on being. It's about being empathic and being self-aware, etc. And this, I think, is in essence where we need to increase people's awareness. It's the way of being that we choose that determines the extent to which we thrive together or not.
No, it is. You were basically pointing and nailing it, that we as humanity are facing a very, very new situation. We've faced the depletion of resources at a certain extent, like, for example, the Roman Empire, for example. But as a species, you know, globally, this is a completely new situation that we are dealing with the complexity of problems as a humanity we have never, ever had to deal before. So when you say being, that we have to sort of develop this being to overcome it, how?
When I ask this question anywhere, and again, I've been doing this for years, you get the same answers from people. You say, how do people become this kind of human being who is empowered with empathy, self-awareness, etc., etc.? And, you know, assuming that you've got to really pay attention in early years and childhood and then through adolescence and into adulthood, people will say, you've got to put young people in charge. You shouldn't do education to young people or do learning to young people. You need to empower them to lead their own learning. So I think that's critically important. They'll say you've got to get young people out into the community and then get adults out into the community, learning in the community, learning through the practice of contributing positively to their own well-being and planetary and societal well-being and planetary well-being together. You need to help people explore and experiment and therefore fail. You've got to encourage people to question and critique, to make and move and meditate. And they start naming all these kinds of learning experiences through which we become holistically empowered to live for universal well-being. And what's troubling is that those experiences are almost never found in school systems. If you think about those experiences I described, and then you think about what the average school experience still is for most young people, it's individualistic. It's not learning together. It's sitting behind desks still, in classrooms still, with textbooks or computers still. It's not about this learning together to thrive together. And the school is still typically closed to the rest of the community. So we are all learning all the time everywhere, but there was kind of... the learning that's happening outside of school is not systematically provided or coordinated or facilitated. So the school is still highly isolated, highly fragmented, highly individualistic, highly focused on economic growth and outdated ideas of economic success. So we somehow have to liberate learning not only from the idea of the acquisition of knowledge and the development of skills, but also from the old idea of schooling. We have to help the whole community learn together, which means intergenerational learning, learning together, certainly in schools or learning hubs or whatever we want to call them, but equally at home, in parks, in museums, in libraries, in restaurants, at shops, wherever that may be, in a coordinated fashion, so that everyone is experiencing a whole rich array of learning experiences through which they stand the maximum chance of becoming empowered to live for universal well-being.
So have you developed a curriculum that embodies these ideas?
Well, not exactly. And I'm slightly allergic to the word curriculum, only insofar as it often invokes the idea of standardization and generalizations. I've done a lot of work in a lot of settings with people in schools and outside of schools who use very different ways of describing this kind of work. By the way, this is one of the problems that we're facing, that the current system, this is an aside by the way, but the current system encourages people who are doing brilliant work to compete with each other, to compete for money, to compete for attention. Mm-hmm. So we differentiate ourselves by the language we use, by the models we use, and we don't share. We don't share our resources, we don't share opportunities, we don't share learnings, even though many of us are actually working towards the same goal. So as a result of that, you've got the character development camp and you've got the values-based education camp and the empathy camp and the Montessori camp and the what, you know, all of these different many camps who aren't really talking or sharing and certainly not collaborating or co-creating. So it seems to me that each neighborhood needs to take ownership of its own learning. This shouldn't be imposed. I don't think it's going to work if this is in any way imposed from outside or above. Having said that, it is helpful, of course, to learn from other communities who are doing this. So the processes that we're defining are not so much curricular in that kind of standardized sense, but suggestion, kind of almost suggested frameworks, models, and narratives that can be helpful to a community in defining its own transformation process.
Could you give a specific example, for example, one community that has gone through this process or that you're thinking about it?
There's all sorts of really interesting work going on. A great friend of ours, Catalina Koch in Medellin in Colombia, she's injecting this process of bringing communities together to define their own futures and to curate their own learning experiences throughout the communities. So essentially she's entering a process which is highly inclusive, which aims to transform Medellin as a city into a learning ecosystem in which everyone is learning to thrive together. So she's entered this process, and it's a fascinating process. She's bringing together people who've been literally killing each other for many years. So she's deliberately bringing together different voices, which is a critical feature of this kind of we call this weaving work. A critical facet to this kind of weaving work is you deliberately recognize that you must bring together diverse voices. Now, of course, that requires a certain kind of human being who is able to hold a space within which there are very diverse voices, including voices that maybe you fundamentally disagree with and dislike. The process involves bringing together the right density of people. So it's not just diverse voices, but you need enough of them who share the same concerns. So this often happens not at the city level, but at the neighborhood level, in this case, which I think is really important. The other thing that she's doing is she's saying, in this process, she's saying it's not only diversity and density, but it is also dynamism. So you have to have a regularity of interaction and a depth of interaction. So a lot of this work is quite deep. She's using sometimes the Presencing Institute and Gaia processes, for example. So she's creating containers within which people can really connect at a deep level. So she's, in a way, watering the roots of the community. And then the fourth dimension is she's saying we must always maintain a direction to our work. So this is the North Star. Where are we trying to get to? This is work that's continuously spiraling. You never say, you know, we're going to go there and forget about it. You're constantly coming back to remind ourselves, where are we trying, which direction are we moving in, and how do we want to move in that direction? So it's both vision and values, essentially. And this is critical work. And once you start to align people to a shared purpose, you can then start to move people to sharing resources and learnings and opportunities. And you can then also start to help people not only collaborate, but collaborate for systemic impact. So that's how do we start shifting systemic mechanisms and mindsets.
Well, it's it feels like I've heard this from the Panchamama, like waking up from our dream, right? Especially the modern world. And I really like that because it sometimes feels to me really like, oops, you know, we have to wake up from this dream, which isn't actually our reality at all. So if I am a community, how do I, and I want to wake up from my dream or I want to evolve and like find my Northern Star, what do I do?
Well, I think the first thing you do is recognize that you can't do it alone. That you're not going to shift the community alone. You need to create a team, and you need to create a small team, because you can't manage or weave a team that is too big. Mm. So you need to find that right set of people to forge that first team, which in a way sometimes it's helpful to think of as a cell in an organism. So if you imagine you want to turn your community into a thriving organism, which will be made up of many cells which die and come to life and co-join, but they're all interconnected in a whole. So you want to create that catalytic cell which will produce other cells and so forth. So you need to find the right people.
When is a good time to invite a weaver into the community?
That is the weaver who's kickstarting that process.
So that person becomes the weaver.
Yep. You need the weaver, that team really needs to be a team of weavers.
Very interesting process, Ross. And I just have a question. I'm a longtime community activist in New York City. So I'm very aware of many processes of trying to transform a community, but there's almost always some infrastructure already in place where there's a community board or a city council or numbers of block associations in the case of a city like ours that are already doing important work, but also have very deep investments in that work happening in a certain way. What is your advice to people who want to become weavers but may not be a part of that infrastructure or may not have access necessarily? I guess I would call them power structures in some ways, not necessarily, but established people in a community.
It's a very important point, I think. So it seems to me that in every community, well, certainly pretty much in every community that I've spent time in, there are people already doing weaving work. And they might be in a government organization or in a business or in a school or in an NGO or in a health center or wherever they may be. There are almost always people doing this work. They often don't think of it in those terms, by the way. And actually, one of the main things that we're finding is just by suggesting to people that they are weaving, this is already giving people a sense of identity and a sense of belonging and a language they can use to talk with each other about their work, to reflect on their work, and therefore to get better at their work. So when I talk about wanting to build the field of weaving, in many ways we're trying to build the profession of weaving. We think this is absolutely critical work and it needs to be professionalized, and I use that word a bit carefully, but it needs to be recognized economically, it needs to be taken more seriously by others, and it needs to be deepened as a practice. So I think that's really important to recognize that. Now, if you're somebody who wants to do this work but who isn't already established in this field, my suggestion would be is just to do sort of classic old school networking, to try and find people who are doing it and learn, find what are people doing, what are people not doing, who's doing work which is complementary, who's talking to who's not talking to who, and start that process of connecting people together who are doing complementary work or even competitive work, try to bring them together and start to forge connections between people. So the other thing I always find is that there are weavers in communities doing this kind of work, and very often they're not talking with each other. So people are kind of weaving in bubbles or vacuums. Mm-hmm. And so there's a role for people to come into these communities to step up and to say, well, how about we all come together and see if we ourselves as weavers can align to a shared North Star, and see if we can collaborate for systemic impact, and see if we can learn together to accelerate and amplify our work.
Yeah, I get so inspired by what you're saying, but basically there's this web of learning and weaving around the globe, right? And how, for me, the main question really is how can we empower those people also economically? And that's for sure not through the current monetary system, you know, that can't work. You cannot pay them in dollars. Anyways, but that's a question which is worth exploring, I think. Yeah. Also
it's
here
a
on
whole
the podcast.
Yeah.
I would love to learn from you in that regard. We are having debate after debate about what is the economy that we should try to create to support this field of weaving learning ecosystems. And we, you know, there are lots of ideas out there, but it would be super to have that conversation at some point.
Is there anything you would really like to the listeners still to know?
My sense is we've reached a point in history where we have critical choices. And I'm not a binary person at all. And I, you know, weaving is never binary. But I think we can now choose to try to go back to the old systems, you know, which is understandable because we can imagine, we can romanticize the idea of stability in the old system and familiarity. If we do that, I think we are going to experience untold suffering in our lifetimes, in the next 10 years. Or we choose to try to move in the direction of thriving. That's not to say we will achieve a state of thriving. We are not going to achieve a utopia. I don't believe that. But we can avoid much suffering and we can create pockets of happiness and thriving around the world if we take that direction, I believe. If we choose the latter, we have to learn to get there. That is moving down that path is a path of learning. If we choose that direction to learn to thrive together, we have to do this collectively. We have to do it in communities. If we choose to do this, we have to therefore adopt a certain way of being in the world. We have to soften our ego. We have to soften our tendency to compete. We have to think systematically. We have to raise awareness of ourselves. We have to elevate and expand our consciousness of who we are, who we're with, what we're doing, where we're going. And that is choosing to adopt a certain way of being. It's choosing to learn to thrive together. It's choosing to collaborate for systemic impact. It's choosing to weave ourselves together towards this North Star of thriving together. For me, it's a choice. It's in some ways a simple choice, but it's a simple choice that demands complex, difficult work. And that, I think, is in a sort of crude nutshell where we are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. That was beautiful.
Thanks,
okay.
Ross.
Have
great
a great
thanks,
evening.
Guys. Have a
Cheers.
Lovely day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there have been movements throughout the last, I don't know, 40 or 50 years to, both in education and in community planning, to do the kinds of work that Ross is talking about, you know, to bring inclusive conversations together to create an interwoven idea of what that community should look like, what the future of that community will be, what are the values that embodied by that community. But he kind of combines these ideas of planning for a community and lifelong learning of all of the members of that community into one process. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, you know, to think that we as human beings really are given the opportunity to learn a new way of being in order to manifest a world that's more sustainable and resilient, or as he says, that thrives together.
Yeah, and when when the thriving together, when you look at a different kind of data, for example, the gross national product, you would think, oh, we do thrive a lot, but in fact, we don't. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is something which came up in our conversation. It's like, what data set are we, like, where is our Northern Star? And what are the data we are basically taking as our sort of guiding posts to get there? And it's very clear that within our current setup of our system today, with the data of, for example, the gross national product, is definitely not leading us
right. There's
to
a lot
a thriving planet.
Yeah, there's not a lot. There's a lot that's not covered. A lot of suffering that's within that gross national product that's not reflected in that number. And you could look at other communities like Bhutan, who's been famous for this gross national happiness index, which is another way of measuring their North Star. And, you know, maybe what Ross is doing around the world will create more different kinds of measurements and more ways of communicating what it means really for us all to thrive.
Ross is very serious. I think he's seen a lot of projects and development stuff during his career. And he has clearly concluded that we are globally, that there are limits to our growth and there is a limit to how we can do stuff. And we have, as he said, we have a choice to make. And he's very serious about this.
Yeah, he seems to be experiencing kind of the choice very deeply. And perhaps that's part of the personal work that he does. You know, he says there's inner work in this for all of us. And for sure, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, the other point is the interdependence, right? We could basically link what you just said to the interdependence of the inner work, which is done, that we are all interdependent. So when you do your own work, you actually already help somebody else.
Well, yeah, it's like a ripple effect. I think if we all work on ourselves and our relationships and get that North Star clear, then we can make that transformation together.
Isn't the North Star also something the sailors already used?
Well, it's what everyone uses.
Columbus, who also used the North Star to get to America.
The North Star is universal navigational tool.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Let's find our North Star.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at podofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.